Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is John Paul.
And this is another X-Men Tuesday episode. Everybody, as you know, if you listen to these X-Tuesday episodes every week, we finally finished up the first two miniseries, which were really one series altogether, Hawks and Pox, House of X, and Powers of Ten. And now we're moving on to the regular series. And we're going to go in the same reading order that's in the back of the book. For each of these titles, just like we did with House of X and Powers of X. I will say that just overall first impressions of the first couple that I've read, it doesn't quite have the same tone that House of X and Powers of 10 had. Those, they had this quality to them of being really monumental and really consequential. And it's not to say that you feel like the events that happen in X-Men number one don't matter, but it feels like, okay, now we got the stories of how the status quo all got set up. And now we're just going to get into the nitty gritty of kind of the day-to-day life of these characters. So that's just kind of the initial impression I got when I read this, this issue, X-Men number one. Do you feel the same way, John Paul?
Yeah. Even from the first time I read it, it's the pace is a little seems slower. I mean, there's like the sense of urgency isn't like as great, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, that's exactly right. Like the stakes just don't feel as high. Like they've established the nation now, and now it's just a matter of kind of getting on with their lives. But everything is already been set up. And I imagine that, well, I don't have to imagine the issues that are not written by Hickman. Now X-Men number one is written by Hickman. So it still retains a little more of the tone of the initial series, as opposed to like the other issue that I've read, Marauders number one, which is written by Jerry Dugan. That really feels like a departure from what we've been reading so far. It's still really good. It just has a very different tone than what we've had so far. So let's go ahead and dive into to issue number one of the X-Men. It starts off and we see just black panels with some dappling of red. And we're told it's then in terms of the timeline. It says, open your eyes. The response is, I can't, sir. I won't. I'm scared of what will happen. So you're getting the idea. Okay, maybe this is a Cyclops and he's got some kind of gauze wrapped around his eyes. And that's why when he's kind of peeking through, everything looks red. As the light is filtering in through the gauze, whoever he's talking to says, I understand you're afraid you might hurt somebody, but choosing to keep your eyes closed because you're scared, that's what they do. So right away, you know, you get the feeling, okay, this must be Professor X. And that's kind of a profound statement. Basically, he's saying that humans are sticking their heads in the sand and they don't want to see, they don't want to know what's coming. They're scared of mutants. And so they'd rather just pretend they don't exist by keeping their eyes closed. Now, the voice goes on to say, you don't have to go through life blind because you're not like them. And Cyclops says, how do you know? And he says, well, because I have no small measure of experience in those who are extraordinary. Now, open your eyes. And we do see that Scott does open his eyes. He's wearing the ruby quartz glasses. He does see the world in reds, looking through these you know, red lens glasses. And Cyclops is surprised that they work. He says, I can see. And Xavier says, better than most, my boy. And again, he's not talking about the visual act of seeing. He's talking about the fact that Cyclops sees the world for what it actually is, as opposed to walking around with his head in the sand, like a lot of the humans do. So Professor X says, hey, the things I'm going to show you, you know, you got a whole brave new world ahead of you. And that's the title of the issue. It says, it's a brave new world. Mutants around the world are flocking to the island nation of Krakoa for safety, security, and to be part of the first mutant society. Standing between that sacred land and the human world are the heroes of mutantdom, the X-Men. So obviously this is the flagship title. And who do we have on the X-Men team? Cyclops, Storm, Polaris, Magneto. Dr. Reyes is listed here as well, although I think she pretty much spends her time on Krakoa. Since she's the kind of the medical staff, if you will. Jean Grey is listed. So is Havoc, Vulcan, another of the Summer Brothers, Wolverine, Cable, Prestige, and Corsair, which I found it interesting that Corsair is there. I mean, he's first of all, he's not even a mutant. Obviously, he's the father of the Summers Brothers. And so that's why he's probably here. But I don't know. I just thought it strange that he was on the page. So next page is the credits, written by Jonathan Hickman. The art is by Linnell Francis Yu. Inks are by Jerry Allen Gulen. Letter or colors rather by Sonny Goh, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And designer, as has been the case throughout the X title so far, is Tom Muller. So then we shift forward to now. And we're apparently at the last Orcus stronghold on Earth. According to Storm, she's talking about how the Orcus organization thought that they could hide from them. But obviously the X-Men were able to find out where this Orcus organization had their last base. And Storm's talking about how if you look close enough, you can see the desperation in their eyes. You know, suicide bombs and serving the greater good are the last refuge of a conquered people. So in her mind, Orcus is already conquered. They're already defeated. And this is just sort of their last gasp. I don't know that Cyclops really buys into that. I think he's a little more careful, or maybe Storm is just wishful thinking, the power of positive thinking, as it were. So Storm actually almost gets taken out by this robot that sneaks up behind her, but Cyclops is able to take it out. And Storm mentions, you know, I'm tired, I guess. That's how this guy was able to sneak up on me. But I don't know what I'm more tired of, these engines of death or the men who continue to insist on making them. So as they turn down the hall, they see a bunch more soldiers that are trying to prevent the X-Men from getting to a certain area of this Orcus stronghold. And Scott's talking about how for years they've endured small wins and they've called it incremental progress. And what they've really needed is a big leap forward. They need something that sort of changes the game and changes the landscape. And that's probably, you could make the argument, what establishing a mutant nation has done. So Cyclops says, this is it. You know, this is how they're going to take that great leap forward, by taking out Orcus and taking out the machines that they're trying to create that will try to exterminate mutants. And, you know, you can look at what the X-Men did and the sacrifices they made in stopping the Mother Mold from coming online, and think about that as a great leap forward as well. So, once they get to the area of the factory where there's these big doors that's concealing something, they realize that Magneto realizes that he's not able to get in to it. It's shielded, and although he can punch through the shields, the actual doors themselves are made out of vibranium. So the fact that right in front of these doors are soldiers that are standing their ground, although they're about to, you know, face off against Storm and Cyclops, clearly it's something that these guys are trained to protect. And Cyclops calls it the beating heart, the main lab. And so he radios up to somebody else and says, we've located the main lab, sir. Do you have a lock on our position? And the response is yes. And when Cyclops says, ready when you are, the entire ceiling above these soldiers who are standing their ground is ripped open. And we see Magneto and Polaris up there above the lab. And I love Magneto. Ever the sort of mutant who looks down on humans, he says, Polaris, I know I can at times be overly demanding, but am I asking too much of a flaw world if I don't want to land on rubble or rabble when my feet touch the ground? So he's ripped this roof open, but he's not about to go in and land, because he doesn't want to land on any of the debris that he just created or any of these soldiers that are there about to fire on him. So he asks Polaris to sort of clear the way, and she does. So once he gets inside, like I mentioned, Cyclops is unable to breach these doors because they're made of vibranium. So Magneto says, stand aside, I'll handle this. And, you know, with his magnetic powers, he begins to rip the doors apart. On the other side of the door is the actual head of Orcus. He's called Dr. Mars. He's the director of Orcus, as they call him. And they're informing him that, hey, they're almost through the door. You know, what should we do? And Dr. Mars is asking, how much redundancy do they have between this hub and the Forge? The Forge being that ring that's close to the sun that once held the Mother Mold head that the X-Men were able to destroy and have fall into the sun, apparently they're still, Orcus is still using that forge as a base. And this hub that the X-Men are attacking, the last Orcus stronghold on Earth, it is the last mainframe they have that contains all of the knowledge base that Orcus has. And so they've been uploading all the data from this data core to the forge that's orbiting the sun, so they can have it safe, far away, and the mutants won't know where it is. There's an 80% overlap. They've managed to copy over 80%, and they're asking Dr. Mars, okay, there's 80% of it has been transferred. Should we begin purging the mainframe? Should we destroy the data core? And Dr. Mars is like, no, we'll lose the information we have forever. It's better if we all make the ultimate sacrifice, rather than surrender one inch to the mutants. And he pulls out this syringe, and the soldiers are asking, wait, what is this? And he says, evolution is an unyielding, apologetic master. And the truth is, we're all too civilized to deal with these vandals. And so he injects himself and the rest of the doctors that are in there with him. And he says, these monsters, and when he says monsters, he's referring to the mutants. These monsters can have my science when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers. So his plan is to inject himself and the rest of the doctors with this serum, which is going to do something that's going to allow them to distract the mutants long enough in order for the rest of the data core, the last 20%, to be transferred to the forge. So after Magneto breaks through and they come walking in with the rest of the team, Polaris and Storm and Cyclops, we see that what that serum has done is it has transformed all those doctors into apes. They start attacking the X-Men. And Magneto says, I've got this, go find them. So really, we on the next page, we find out what else is being hidden behind this door, which is really the reason that the X-Men have come here in the first place. They find a bunch of stasis tubes, dozens of them, and each of them contains a mutant. Orcus has either been experimenting on them or using them to test certain things. You know, how do we defeat mutants? How do we isolate the X gene? You know, things like that. And the X-Men are there to free these mutants because, you know, the island nation of Krakoa, the nation of mutants, has been established. Everybody is welcome there, and that includes anybody who is being held prisoner somewhere. So that's the whole reason for this attack on the base. So Storm plants a flower that grows into a gateway to Krakoa. They open all the stasis tubes and prepare to have everybody walk through the gateway to Krakoa. One of the ones they open, they realize that it's not a mutant in there, but it's something different. When they open it up, it's this girl, and she, for lack of a better term, she looks like a photograph negative. Everything that's dark is light, and everything that should be light is dark. So her skin is black, but her hair is white. And she has some sort of powers of mental manipulation because she tries to convince Storm and Polaris that she's not there. She holds out her hand to them, and she says, I'm not here. You don't see me. And Storm's like, what are you talking about? I'm looking right at you. And Polaris is examining her and saying, okay, it looks like this is a human, but they're beyond the tachyon bleed, which suggests some sort of temporal development. So technically they're post-human. So whether she came back from the future or this is Orcus's first attempts at creating something post-human, accelerating human evolution, we saw in that sixth life of Moira that's the pathway that humans went down and eventually tried to ascend and become part of the Phalanx. So this little girl, after she tries to convince Storm and Polaris that they can't see her, she kind of collapses. She says, I'm weak. I'm so weak. And Storm is trying to comfort her. And this girl says that she emerged before she was fully cooked. She calls it a child born out of time. She said, but I had to, don't you see, there are wild gods loose in this world. And as she says that, Magneto starts walking in to the room, and he says, the only gods on this planet stand here before you. So again, Magneto, you might be on the side of the good guys now, or the mutants, allied with Xavier and Moira, but he's still as arrogant as ever. And the girl says, I have to go. And she teleports herself away. So they're able to translocate and find her. And Magneto says, okay, she can't have gotten far. Let's go chase her down. But Cyclops says no, he's technically in charge of this operation. And he says, that's not our priority. If the council wants to make it our priority later on, we can deal with that. And obviously that's a reference to the Quiet Council that rules Krakoa. But he says, for right now, we have more important things to do. They need to fulfill their mission, which is getting all these children home, all these mutants that have been captured back home. So this issue starts off with a lot of action. And with this being the last stronghold on Earth for Orcus, you sort of start to think, well, okay, maybe this is the last. Maybe this is just Hickman cleaning up some threads. Orcus really seems like they don't have a leg to stand on if they don't have any sort of bases on Earth left. We know they don't have the mother mold. How much of a threat could they really be? But at the same time, you get the impression that they could end up being the big bad. So it could go either way. And knowing Hickman, it's probably going to go more of the latter than the former. I don't know that he would bother to have created an organization like Orcus and make them seem so formidable just to say, well, they're not around anymore. So you almost think that them not being on Earth is sort of, that's an advantage for them because they're not going to be around where the X-Men might be aware of what's going on. And it's so interesting too, that just the whole idea of Orcus, it's almost like weaponizing or militarizing this idea of human against mutant, which is that concept's been around with the X-Men forever. But now not only are the X-Men taking the fight to the humans or saying, we're not going to stand for that anymore. They're finally standing up for themselves, creating a mutant nation and whatnot. The humans are sort of, you know, they've been in the background in the past with Bolivar Trask and whatnot, creating Sentinels. And, you know, it's been little organizations or little radicals, you'd say. You know, these people, they don't really stand for what most humans think. And, you know, they want to exterminate mutants, but they're the exception rather than the rule. Orcus feels much bigger than that. They feel much more mainstream. And they definitely feel like a precursor to an all-out human mutant war, which supposedly is exactly what establishing this island nation of Krakoa is supposed to prevent. So I find them to be the whole idea of Orcus to be very, very intriguing. What do you think, John Paul?
Well, I think Orcus, you know, is finally the last stage of, how do I say it? I'm surprised that none of the other superhuman organizations have caught on to Orcus because I guess that their sole objective is targeted towards mutants. That's why it doesn't really come up for other superheroes, but it's more of I think it would be more of a Marvel-wide universe threat that at least some of the other superhumans would have looked into it by now.
Yeah, especially because they're, you know, Orcus has taken parts of other organizations that are on the radar of other heroes, you know, like AIM or Hydra or Hammer or whatever. So you just kind of wonder why they're not seen as a bigger threat. So anyway, on the next page, we actually get a look at Krakoa, Living Island, Mutant Nation State. We see all the children that just got rescued come through the gateway. They all are introduced to Dr. Reyes. She's going to examine everybody and make sure they're okay. And despite Storm's tiredness, she decides that she wants to stay specifically to take a look while Dr. Reyes examines a couple of these children, because there's two of them who haven't spoken at all, but they're radiating a lot of energy. One is like metallic gold, just humanoid form, and the other is metallic silver humanoid form. There's no hair or really any kind of features. They look like little mini silver surfers, but one's gold and one's silver or white. And Cyclops is kind of surprised. He's like, I thought you were tired. We've been going nonstop for a week. I'm surprised that you want to stay. And she says, yes, I'm sure I'm tired of fighting, but I'll never be tired of lifting up our own. So that kind of summons up or sums up Storm pretty well there. So Cyclops says, okay, fair enough. I'll check in later just in case. And then Magneto comes walking through the gate and he gets a hero's welcome. It's clear that because he's so militant and because he's so powerful and because he constantly speaks his mind about standing up for mutants and battling the humans, that he's already becoming a hero amongst the younger generations of mutants. And they say some of them express an interest in going to fight with him next time. And to Magneto's credit, he doesn't encourage that. He says, I've spent my life fighting, so you wouldn't have to. It's worth it now because we all have Krakoa, and Krakoa is all you need. But one of them does say, well, what happens if the mutants or the humans come here and try to take it from us? Like they always try to take what we have. I'm not afraid. I won't run. And Magneto says, you won't have to, for I'm Magneto. Let man run from me, which then elicits a whole nother round of cheers. And Polaris is looking on and says to Cyclops, well, it's like Magneto's a young man again. He's encouraged by what he sees, the younger generation and the adulations that he's getting. And Cyclops says, you know what? He's waited a long time for this. We all have. And it's kind of nice for them to finally have it. So then Polaris asks Cyclops if he's headed home, and he says, yeah, Dad's in town for a visit. The whole family's there, Alex too. You're welcome to come. And Polaris is like, maybe next time when the past is the past and I'm not still finding my way in a new land. So I'm not up on the whole Polaris Havoc relationship. I don't know what's going on with that. I mean, I know they were an item for a long time, but I don't know where they currently stand. I mean, I like Polaris as a character, but I just don't know what she's been up to, anything prior to the X-Men disassembled. But Cyclops, in response to her saying, she's still finding her way in a new land, he says, yeah, it is something. I remember the day my son was born and how scared I was, not scared of being a father, but just scared of the world that I had brought him into. I was responsible for bringing this innocent child into this world, and he was going to be a mutant, and there's horrors, and all of a sudden my son would have to endure pain and trial just because he was my son, just because he was like me, just because he was a mutant. And the worst part was I was right. It did suffer, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. All I could do was endure it and try not to surrender and try not to give up. But I'll tell you, it was a close thing, surrendering to the world, really close. But I held on, and now look, I have you, I have your father, I have my family, I have my boy, and we're home. We have our own island nation because I believed in a thing, and now it's real. And Polaris is kind of surprised by that. She says, Scott, do you really believe that? And so Scott turns her and he says, every single word of it. So you could say that Cyclops has always been a true believer. There have been times where he's been more cynical than others, but he clearly believes in what they're building here. But again, one of the things I thought was strange, to go back to talking about relationships, it really threw me when Cyclops says, and look, I have you and your father and my boy, my family. When he said, I have you, I'm like, wait, is it Scott and Polaris now? Because that's just weird. But then I guess it's not. Like, I don't know. And maybe we're going to see some of that play out. Maybe, I mean, it's a different timeline, the way things, I mean, it's always been Scott and Jean and Havoc and Polaris. So I don't know. Was there something that happened before John Paul that I'm not aware of? Or is there something that's going to happen?
No, there's
No.
nothing.
Okay.
No,
Okay. All right. So
it's
maybe
not
it's
what you think.
okay. So maybe it's foreshadowing, something that Hickman has planned, which he likes to do that. He likes to
That's
throw in,
possible.
little tidbits like that. And I think a lot of people just goes right over their head. But for some reason, it jumped right out to me. I'm like, wait, what? He has you? What? It's Cyclops and Polaris. That's just weird. I'd be like, I imagine one of my brothers going out with one of my girlfriends, or my main girlfriend. Yeah, that's just weird. Anyway, the scene does shift back to the Orcus Forge that I mentioned. It's that ring around the sun that no longer has the mother mold head, but apparently it is still functional. And it says Orcus was created to be the last gasp of the last generation. It was a doomsday weapon composed of human minds, the greatest ever assembled. And again, like I was saying, it's parts of so many different organizations, from Shield and AIM and Armor and Alpha Flight, Hammer, even six Infernal Geneticists from Hydra. And here's the director again, and he's speaking to the Omega Sentinel, and he's saying, yes, there were lesser evils that we tolerate for the greater good, like the geneticists from Hydra, because what we do here matters. It's all about survival. So we know Orcus just sees mutants as this plague, and they, for them, it's a zero-sum game. It's them or us. It's mutants or it's humans. They cannot coexist in the mind of Orcus. The director even says, the enemy of Orcus is the future. And this is what comes from forgetting that. This, when he says this, the failure at the Forge, losing the mother mold head, this is what comes from forgetting that what they're fighting is inevitability. What they're fighting is the future. They know that Homo Superior is the genetic future of humans, and that's what they're fighting. They're fighting to turn back time, to push the sun back up into the sky. And when you really start to think about it like that, for all the genius of all these people, you know, these scientists from SHIELD and AIM and Armor and Alpha Flight and geneticists from Hydra, and clearly the director is a very intelligent man. You have the Omega Sentinel, who has high-level intelligence. Stop and think about what you're trying to do. You're trying to stop the inevitability of the future. First of all, it's completely arrogant. Second of all, it's completely moronic, because you're not going to be able to stop it. I just don't get it. Like, somebody needs to be the voice of reason, but obviously these are zealots. These are people that you can't speak reason to. But logically in my brain, I just listen to the words you're saying. You're saying that your enemy is the future. You can't stop the future from coming, no matter how hard you try. But Orcus apparently is going to kind of give it their best. And the director says, mutants just look at what they've done. And we get a scene of, it's like a hangar or some big open area where there's a bunch of coffins with Orcus symbols on them from all the people that died during the previous X-Men attack. So the Omega Sentinel says, well, the same sun that powers this station powers them. You know, it gives life to Earth, Director Devo. And your two races exist in a closed system for now. So anything that you do, any action you take against the mutants is going to have repercussions on the humans and vice versa. And so conflict, it was unavoidable. Yeah, you're right, Omega Sentinel. Conflict is unavoidable, assuming you're taking action against the mutants. But guess what? If you actually try to live in harmony with them, then there won't be any repercussions. You know, if you push on them, they're not going to push back. So if you don't push on them, you don't get pushed back. It's a pretty simple concept here. But again, they're zealots. They have their beliefs. They want to wipe out mutants. They're filled with hate and jealousy and fear more than anything. And Devo's response to that statement by the Omega Sentinel saying conflict was unavoidable, he says, well, I read Dr. Greger's reports, and I know you all saw this disaster coming. He says, rather, you saw this disaster coming. The Omega Sentinel knew it was coming. She obviously has a higher level of intelligence. And she says, yeah, the signs were there for anybody who knew what to look for. And Director Devo says, well, not everybody has a computer brain like you. So humans were always going to be slave to our emotions. And in that spirit, we built this Forge. You know, we felt it would be the last hope of humanity, a way to finally exterminate the mutants, and a great refuge in case evolution saw fit to leave mankind behind. And the Omega Sentinel says, well, you know, it's one thing to shake your fist at God in frustration. It's something altogether to call down the thunder. You know, you put 93 million miles between Earth and this station, and that's a human deterrent, not a mutant one. So I love that. I love everything she says here. You know, she's saying it's one thing to be angry at nature, angry at evolution, angry at God, angry at something that's beyond your control, that's out of your power, to be frustrated. Why are mutants? Why do they exist? Why is Homo Superior better than Homo Sapien? Why are we going to eventually be replaced? And you can be mad about that, and you can shake your fist at God, somebody who's, you know, far above your station, but you can't do anything about it. But it's another thing altogether to call down the thunder. And what she's saying there, and what I think she's saying there is, it's another thing to try to do something about it and attract that attention, right? It's one thing to shake your fist at God, but when you do something to kind of poke him, to prod him, to give him no choice but to act and call down thunder, call down action upon you, you know, it kind of mirrors what she was saying before about it being a closed system. And if you push on the mutants, they're going to push back. Well, you created this forge and you were about to bring this mother mold online that was going to start producing master molds and eventually lead to the creation of Nimrods. You didn't give the mutants any choice but to react. And maybe you thought that putting 93 million miles between the Earth and the station would stop humans. And you're probably right. It's a human deterrent, but not mutants. They're too powerful. And we saw that they came here, and even though they had to sacrifice themselves momentarily, on a temporary basis, they were able to destroy the mother mold head. So the Omega Sentinel goes on to say, placing another mother mold in orbit around the sun was always going to spark a response. And she starts to say, Dr. Greger was, and Director Deva doesn't want to hear it. He says, no, the blame is mine, not hers. He doesn't blame her for what happened, because he's the one who designed this station. This was his plan, and it was designed to uplift the previous models, and it was him who adapted it. And he says, I only wish I'd been here to try and stop them. So I will give him credit that this was his plan, and he's the leader, and he takes responsibility. But I don't know what the heck he thinks he could have done if he was there. And the Omega Sentinel even kind of expresses the same thought. She's like, it's better that you were in transit. Humans need leaders, pack behaviors dependent on them. And all she's saying is, we need you to be the leader of Orcus. And if you'd been here, you'd be dead too. That would be of no use. So they say it's bad enough that Dr. Greger remains compromised and that so many died. Losing the director would have made the whole experiment pointless. So you kind of wonder what they're planning on doing, because all this time they're talking, they are sending these what looks to be coffins out into space, in, you know, close to where the sun is, and we do get a look at the forge with that head missing out of the middle, and it looks like these coffins are being shot into the sun. But why are they there? What is the value of the forge without that mother mold head, without the ability to bring a factory online that can create other master molds? You wonder, is it just the distance? Is it just out of sight, out of mind? Like I was saying earlier, if they're not on Earth, if they're not operating on Earth, maybe they can avoid being detected by the mutants. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But to contradict what I was saying earlier about, you know, that factory being the last Orcus stronghold on Earth, and you wonder if this is their last gasp, you know, you read a few pages further and it's clear that they're not going away anytime soon. And they are the quote unquote big bad. They are the nemesis that this new mutant nation is going to have to fear, and is going to have to be vigilant to make sure that they're able to monitor and be aware of anything that Orcus is doing. As we turn the page, we are told we're in the summer house, a mutant habitat, and Corsair is there talking to his son Cyclops, and Cyclops is talking about how when they all got to Krakoa, they asked where people wanted to live, and Cyclops didn't really worry about it. He was happy to just hang out under the stars of Krakoa, and the more he thought about it, the more he wanted a place with a view that was kind of private. And since Krakoa can grow a habitat anywhere, he thought, you know, why not go for broke? And so they've actually grown a Krakoan habitat next to the blue area of the moon. And they can use it not only as the summer house where all the summer brothers live, along with, you know, various relatives and significant others and whatnot. They can also use it as a staging area. And we saw that when the X-Men were flying to the Forge, how they launch from the moon. And it was from the summer house. So it's basically just a family get together. Vulcan is doing some barbecuing, and different members of the summer household are there, kind of interacting with members of Corsair Star Slammers. And it's just a good time, just a reminder of kind of the family and the fellowship of these mutants and how they are in so many ways are more than just a superhuman team. They really are a family. I do find it interesting that Wolverine lives at the summer house as well. You kind of take that to be, well, Scott lives at the summer house, which makes sense. And if Scott's going to be living at the summer house, then Jean Grey is going to be living at the summer house. And if Jean Grey's living at the summer house, then Wolverine's going to be living at the summer house as well. And we did see in the aftermath of X-Men Disassembled and the Uncanny X-Men series from Matthew Rosenberg that Wolverine and Cyclops did come to somewhat of an understanding. They weren't aren't they don't quite butt heads the way that they used to. So once it's time for dinner, right as they're about to sit down, they do tell Corsair that they have a present for them, and they give him one of the flowers from Krakoa, and he says, "Oh, it's nice. It's a plant. It's a flower." Okay, I don't get it. And Cyclops says, "It's actually a Krakoan gate, Dad. It's linked with the one we have here in the house. And all you've got to do when you get to the Starjammers Arboretum is you plant it there, and it'll grow into the gate. And then, no matter where you are in the whole universe, you'll always be just a short walk away." So, you know, it was one thing when we knew Krakoa could grow these gates on Earth. And it would be instant teleportation from one place to another. And now we find out that you can put a, first of all, I'm not even sure how the plant grows on the moon because there's no oxygen or water or whatever, but somehow it does. And now we find out that obviously the Arboretum on the Star Slammer, of course, their ship is going to have, you know, soil and oxygen and water, much more conducive to the growth of a plant than the moon. But the bigger thing here, the bigger significance of what Cyclops just said, no matter where you are in the universe, like Krakoa as a mutant is so powerful that no matter how far apart those gates are, they can be, you know, nearly a universe apart. A Corsair can step through and instantly be transported. That is pretty damn powerful. When you think about it. So once Corsair hears what it is, he gets a big smile on his face and says, "Yeah, I know, I love it." So Scott says, "All right, it's been a good day. The first of many, let's eat." And on the next page, we get some text, one of these text pages that talks about the summer house, how it's on the blue area of the moon. And while all mutants are technically welcome, Vulcan, one of the Summers brothers, has been bringing home quite a few acquaintances from the Krakoan mainland who have stretched the acceptable bounds of decorum. And that's interesting to me because I'm going to talk about that when we get to the designs on the next page. And we get the layout. There's an observation deck on the top, tactical operations, a gym. Level 4 is central living, dining, sleeping area. 5 is hangar and turnabout. 6 is sublunar biome, pool, and gateway access. On the next page, we get more of an overview cutout, and around the outside of the base is where all the kind of living quarters are, the pods, as it were. We've got the kitchen, the dining, and the living area, and then we have the various rooms. And I'll just run down a list of the people that have rooms there: Cyclops, Wolverine, Jean, Vulcan, Havoc. There's an empty one, Cable, another empty, and Rachel. What I want to point out here, and I'm really curious to see if you noticed this the first time you looked at this map, John Paul, is when you look at 10, 11, 12, 12 is in the middle of 10 and 11. 12 is Jean Grey. 10 is Cyclops on one side. 11 is Wolverine on the other side. And unlike every other room, which is circular and singular, there is a little hallway that goes from 12 to 11 and 10 to 12. So Jean's in the middle, and without going out into the common area, Wolverine can walk into her room, and so can Cyclops.
Okay, well, I know that you noticed in the celebration in the House of X6, all three of them were together. Remember that panel?
Yeah, they got like. I think Cyclops was in the middle. He had
Yeah.
his arm around each one. Yeah.
There was so much chatter on Twitter when this first came out, and they saw the room layout and the passageways. Oh man, it's a big thing. Is it touched on as much as people might think? No. but it's more of a like implied thing. It's like, oh yes, there's different rules to how
Yeah, like
couples or throuples, as you would
thruple,
say.
yeah. Is it that, or is it just that she loves them both? And sometimes Wolverine, it's Wolverine's night or it's Cyclops' night. I don't know. I don't know. I find it interesting. I like the idea of Cyclops and Jean together. Scott and Jean. I'll always be a Scott and Jean guy. Wolverine for me. Wolverine Jean. I never understood. Like I kind of understood it, and I think they one of the things they actually got right in the first X-Men movie was that attraction. Like Jean knew it was kind of like she knows she shouldn't be attracted to him. He's kind of like the bad boy kind of thing. But more of it had to do with Jean's compassion and how much Wolverine had gone through in his life. And that's where the attraction came from. But the type of attract to me, the type of attraction, and this is the same for the comics, the type of attraction that Jean has felt, even going back to the earliest days of the Claremont era, for Wolverine, those aren't the kind of feelings of attraction that stand the test of time. It's kind of like, I don't want to say lust because that makes it sound cheap, but it's something that wears off over time. Once you get to know somebody, kind of the initial excitement of, oh, they're a dangerous person or they're the bad boy, that kind of stuff, as you get to know somebody, it kind of fades. And a lot of times it ends up becoming a really strong friendship, which I feel is where Wolverine or Logan and Jean should be. But I don't write X-Men. I don't necessarily have a problem with this. I kind of feel the same, like you just explained it, where people made a big deal, but whatever, it's not really addressed. I almost feel like you said when that panel came out with Jean and Scott and Wolverine that people made a big deal about it.
Well, more of this room layout than that panel.
But was, well, what I'm wondering is, did Hickman do this because there was people complaining about that panel, people reading into that panel, and Hickman went, oh, you know what? Then I'm gonna mess with you people because you made a thing out of that. I could
It
totally
sounds
see
like
him.
something he would do.
Yes, I could totally see him doing that. But it's hard not to notice because it is so obvious. So I was curious if it was a thing or not. So anyway, later Cyclops is doing the dishes and Corsair comes up to help him and says, ah, why don't you wash and I'll dry. And Cyclops like, ah, it doesn't quite work that way. We actually spray it with this Krakoan goo and it eats all the bacteria and then it converts itself into this elemental gas and evaporates and leaves us with clean plates. And Corsair's grimacing, looking at him, going, son, that's disgusting. I think I'm going to vomit. And Cyclops is like, well, you think this is bad? You should have seen the kind of the biological plates that or edible plates that he was trying to get us to use first, where he was using the biological functions of the edible plates to try to improve the taste of the food. Oh man, the plates and the goo, that this is a compromise. And Corsair's kind of shaking his head. He's like, man, your world sure has changed. And Cyclops says, yes, it has, and for the better. And Corsair, you know, he's there with his son. He's sharing a moment, and he does feel sort of obligated as a father, you know, to express his concerns because he's just a human, right? And he even says, "I forgive my simple-minded human observation. You've always lived a dangerous life, and it's cost you over the years. But what you're doing now, it feels even more dangerous. I'm worried. I'm worried about you, and you can see why. I mean, the mutants, which includes the Summers brothers, they really are pushing the boundaries. They're leveling up. They're not going to stand by and take it anymore. But in that way, you're also sort of painting a target on yourself. And, you know, Corsair, as a father who cares about his sons, is kind of expressing that concern that he has. And Scott says, you know what? Here's the thing I figured out, Dad. There's no end to the number of things on Earth or hell or the universe or whatever that are out there trying to kill mutants. They never stop coming and they never will. And, you know, they're all the same that way. So, sure, I'm a fighter and I'm never going to stop fighting for what I believe in. But I live here now, right? This extension of Krakoa. And I'm surrounded by the people I love. So I'm done focusing on the things that want me dead and trying to fight against those things. And instead, I'm choosing to stay focused on the things that make me want to live. And I think that's a great philosophy and certainly a departure from the sort of radicalized Cyclops that kind of how he was before he died, that version of Cyclops that just for me just didn't work at all. And so Corsair puts his arm around Cyclops and says, okay, you're a good boy. You know, he likes that answer. Meanwhile, back at the Forge, Director Devo goes to see Dr. Gregor, and she's working in her lab, and she says, well, I'm heard that you arrived first out, last in. Always the soft bed for the men behind the curtain. You know, she sounds a little bitter. Obviously, she's upset that her husband is dead. And Director Devo even says, you're angry with me. And she says, well, you think I shouldn't be angry at you, at them? Like, I shouldn't be mad? And Director Devo says, well, yeah, if you want to use that rage for whatever it gets you, that's fine. But don't get lost along the way or lose sight of what our goals are. And she says, lose sight? And, you know, and maybe it's the expression that he's using, because I didn't mention this before, but Director Devo is blind, and he's got these implants that allow him to actually see. And in her, in response to her saying lose sight, he says, well, it's true. I was born blind, but through science, I can see the world in infrared or ultraviolet or 100 different ways. And there's not much that gets by me. There's not much that I don't observe, especially when I'm looking closely. And I didn't see you at the funeral earlier, the funeral for your husband. And Dr. Gregor says, there wasn't even enough of Killian left to bury. Why would I have been there? And even if there were, it's just a shell. It's nothing more. What he was lives here. And she taps herself on the chest, and here, and she points to her work. And Director Devo doesn't disagree. He says, yeah, he was our best military mind, the greatest strategist and hunter and a great man. You know, and losing him, we lost so much. And Dr. Gregor says, yes, I know. But, well, I guess now is as good a time as any. And she reaches out toward whatever she's been working on, this little crystal, and she pulls it out of the chamber. And she says, would you like to know a secret, Director? I know how to bring him back. And she's holding this crystal. So maybe the mutants aren't the only ones who have a way of resurrecting and bringing back the dead. But I'll tell you what, as much as I think that Xavier is keeping secrets and he may not completely be on the up and up, I trust Professor Xavier with the ability to resurrect people a lot more than I do Orcus. So we turn the page and we get coming soon, and it's the reading order. So X-Men number one, which is what we're covering now, and next episode we'll be covering Marauders number one. So great first issue. It's oversized. I think it's 32 pages or so. And it really divided up into three particular parts, although the Orcus part is divided up in a couple different sections. We get the first part where the X-Men are there rescuing the kids from the Orcus compound. We get the Orcus stuff on the Forge, and then we get the Summers house. So it's a good mix of action, of where Orcus is currently and where the X-Men are currently. And I think that Hickman uses sort of the point of view character and sort of the viewpoint of Cyclops to sort of give us the status quo for all the mutants. They're all sort of looking at the world the way that Cyclops is, right? Like they've spent their entire existence fighting against all the things in the universe, all the things on Earth, all the things in hell and whatever alternate realities that have been trying to kill them. That's what they've always been focused on. And instead of focusing on all those things, all the negative, all the threat, all the things that want to kill them, instead they're going to focus on each other. They're going to focus on the things they love and the things that make them happy and the things that make them want to live. Instead of focusing on the things that want to make them dead, they're going to focus on the things that want to remind them that they're alive. And so I think that's a really good viewpoint to have. As I said, it's certainly a different perspective from the radicalized Cyclops that we had before he died. And it's a really good outlook and much more true to who Cyclops is as a character from Hickman. So a really great job there. I thought this was a great issue. Like I said, the tone does change a little bit from what we had in the initial sort of two first miniseries, but it is still Hickman, so you do still feel his fingerprints all over it. Once we get to some of the other series, it feels a little less like that. What are your thoughts on this issue, John Paul?
Well, I like this issue. Like I had mentioned earlier, it's a little bit more slower paced, but there were some parts in it that really made me think, and like in my personal life, when Cyclops is mentioning about fatherhood and all the things that he was afraid of, bringing a child into a cruel world. That's something I still think about, and that kind of like touched with me personally. I'm not a father, but like I've thought about that. I don't know where this little crystal at the end that Dr. Gregor has to do with bringing back her husband, even to this point.
Really?
I don't know. Did I miss something? I had completely forgotten about that. So I don't think he's come back around to that. And one last thing, I really like Renew You as an artist, but there were times in the issue where I felt like the facial expressions just weren't there. Like I didn't feel emotion other than a straight grimace.
Yeah, I was going to, if you hadn't mentioned it, I was going to ask you what you thought of the art, because there are certain panels where, yeah, it's just not up to his normal standards. Like when we see this close up of Storm, it doesn't even look like, if I didn't know that was Storm from the context of the story, I would never guess that was Storm. It looks like some weird old lady. Like I have no idea. This is definitely not his best work, and he may be one of those that really benefits from a good inker. And I don't know, maybe this is an inker that he hasn't worked with before, but yeah, I felt
now that you mentioned that, he had worked with this inker before, and unfortunately last year, this inker passed away.
That's too bad. Because yeah, I feel the same way when we see Professor X for the first time in the first couple pages. It's almost like it's over rendered there. It's almost like there's too many lines, because in the panel right above it where Scott's putting on the glasses, the art looks fine. It looks pretty clean. And then you go down just one panel and there's all these extraneous lines on Xavier's face, and it artificially ages them, and it makes the art look dirty in a way. So yeah, it's not his best work in terms of rendering. But I think overall the art is not bad. He certainly handles the action scenes really well. I've never been a big fan of his transitions from panel to panel. They are pretty choppy. Like the action moves along pretty quickly, and that might just be the direction that Hickman's giving him. You know, Hickman, his stories are dense, you know, so you're packing a lot of information into, a very small amount of space. So if it feels like we're going fast in terms of what's happening from one panel to the next, that might just be a factor of kind of the story, how much story Hickman's trying to squeeze into these pages. So I won't necessarily fault Linnell for that, but unfortunately there's nobody else I can point the finger at when it comes to the rendering. It's not his best work, and that's not to say the art is bad. It's just I've seen him do better, and mostly it's just it looks a little scratchy, you know. It looks a little unfinished. It doesn't look polished.
Yeah,
I think the color work is done really well though.
The next few X-Men issues, I believe, are done by Lanil Yu, and I see an improvement just from recollection. I'd have to look over it again, but and one of the issues that came out not too long ago is one of my favorite X-Men issues ever. But I have a high bias towards Magneto, so.
Well, the other thing that might be at play here, you know, we mentioned it. It's more than a standard issue. It's almost a double sized issue. So you wonder if he was just, you know, if they gave him a double sized issue or an issue that was more than the 20 pages that he's used to doing in a month, he may have been rushed. We don't know. You would hope that he would have had plenty of time with the lead up, but it might, I mean, a lot of times an artist may not find out until the last minute. Oh, by the way, instead of 20 pages, this one's 30. And all of a sudden you've just increased their workload by 50%. So that's a possibility as well. So, all right. Anything else we want to add?
No, that's it.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Like I said, next time we'll be covering Marauders number one from Jerry Dugan. So as always, we want to thank you all for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.